Chapter 12. Divine Transgression. After the ruination of Eden, the human story heads south in a hurry. That's to be expected. The curses that followed the events in the garden bound the fate of humanity together with the seed of the Noshish, all those who oppose the rule of God in either the earthly or spiritual realm. The rule of God, known as Eden, would disappear, kept alive only through a fledgling humanity to whom God extended mercy. The seed of the Noshish is therefore literal. People and divine beings are real and spiritual. The lineage is one of spiritual rebellion. This description has secure biblical roots. Jesus told the Pharisees, "You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father," John 8:44, "and call them serpents and offsprings of vipers," Matthew 22:33. In 1 John 3, the Apostle John expresses the notion of spiritual seed, good or evil, manifesting itself in the human heart when he wrote, "The one who practices sin is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. For this reason, the Son of God was revealed, in order to destroy the works of the devil. Everyone who is fathered by God does not practice sin, because his seed resides in him. And he is not able to sin, because he has been fathered by God. But this, the children of God and the children of the devil, are evident. Everyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, namely the one who does not love his brother. For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one and violently murdered his brother. And for what reason did he violently murder him? Because his deeds were evil and the deeds of his brother were righteous." 1 John 3:8-28. This passage describes people whose lives are characterized by wickedness as children of the devil, a contrast to the spiritual children of God. This is a spiritual lineage. Since the children of God have God's seed abiding in them, a reference to the Holy Spirit, Peter echoes the same thought in 1 Peter 1:23, where he describes those born again, literally born from above, as being born not as mortal offspring or seed, but of imperishable seed through the word of God. The language then points toward the spiritual, following Yahweh or following the example of the original rebel, the Noshish. Interestingly, John mentions Cain specifically. Cain murdered Abel sometime after their parents were expelled from Eden, the point at which we've arrived in our exploration. Cain's spiritual father was the Noshish. They walked the same path. Things eventually got so bad that in Genesis 6:5 we read, "And Yahweh saw that the evil of humankind was great upon the earth, and every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was always only evil." But that verdict is preceded by four verses that describe a different kind of rebellion, a divine one. There are those in that realm who, as the Noshish had done, made a free choice that violated God's design and strategy for his rule on earth. In what remains of this chapter, we'll take a closer look at this divine transgression, focusing on how the account has been stripped of its supernatural features, and therefore its intended meaning, by most Christian interpreters. We'll continue the discussion in the two chapters that follow, where we'll examine how the original context and intent of the passage compels a supernatural interpretation, and then explore that interpretation's implications. Precursor to the Flood, Divine Rebellion. Genesis 6:1-4 is one of those texts that many readers and pastors would rather skip. Not here. Its theological message is important. "And it happened that, when humankind began to multiply on the face of the ground, daughters were born to them. Then the sons of God saw in daughters of humankind's that they were beautiful, and they took them for themselves wives of all that they chose. And Yahweh said, My spirit shall not abide with humankind forever, in that he is also flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were upon the earth in those days, and afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humankind, and they bore children to them, these were the mighty warriors that were from ancient time, men of renown. There are few Bible passages that raise as many questions as this one. Who are the sons of God? Are they divine or human? Who were the Nephilim? How do these verses relate to the human evil described in Genesis 6:5? Before we start tackling these questions and others, we need to learn how not to interpret this passage. The Sethite interpretation. This interpretation of Genesis 6:1-4 is the one most commonly taught in Christian churches, evangelical or otherwise. It has been the dominant Christian position since the late 4th century A.D. In this approach, the sons of God in Genesis 6:1-4 are merely human beings, men from the line of Seth, Adam and Eve's son, who was born after Cain murdered Abel. Genesis 4:25-26, 5:3-4. Presumably, these four verses describe forbidden intermarriage between the godly men of Seth's lineage, sons of God, and the ungodly women of Cain's line, daughters of humankind. In this reading, everyone who lived on earth ultimately came from these two lines, but both of the lines descended from Adam and Eve's children. In this way, the Bible distinguishes the godly from the ungodly. Part of the rationale for this view comes from Genesis 4:26, where, depending on the translation, we read that either Seth or humankind began to call on the name of the Lord. The line of Seth was to remain pure and separate from evil lineage. The marriages of Genesis 6:1 through 4 erased this separation and incurred the wrath of God in the flood. Exposing the deficiencies of the Sethite view isn't difficult. The position is deeply flawed. First, Genesis 4:26 never says the only people who called on the name of the Lord were men from Seth's lineage. That idea is imposed on the text. Second, as we'll see in the next chapter, the view fails miserably in explaining the Nephilim. Third, the text never calls the women in the episode daughters of Cain. Rather, they are daughters of humankind. There is no actual link in the text to Cain. This means that the Sethite view of the text is supported by something not present in the text, which is the very antithesis of exegesis. Fourth, there is no command in the text regarding marriages or any prohibition against marrying certain persons. There are no Jews and Gentiles at this time. Fifth, nothing in Genesis 6:1 through 4 or anywhere else in the Bible identifies people who came from Seth's lineage with a descriptive phrase, sons of God. That connection is purely an assumption through which the story is filtered by those who hold the Sethite view. A close reading of Genesis 6:1 through 4 makes it clear that a contrast is being created between two classes of individual, one human and the other divine. When speaking of how humanity was multiplying on earth, verse 1, the text mentions only daughters. Daughters were born to them. The point is not literally that every birth in the history of the earth after Cain and Abel resulted in a girl. Rather, the writer is setting up a contrast of two groups. The first group is human and female, the daughters of humankind. Verse 2 introduces another group for the contrast, the sons of God. That group is not human, but divine. There are more deficiencies in this viewpoint than I will take time here to expose, but the point is evident. The Sethite hypothesis collapses under the weight of its own incoherence. Divinized human rulers. Another approach that argues the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1 through 4 are human suggests that they should be understood as divinized human rulers. A survey of the academic literature arguing this perspective reveals that it springs from the following. 1. Taking the phrase sons of the Most High in Psalm 82 as referring to humans, then reading that back into Genesis 6, 1 through 4. 2. Noting that language where God refers to humans as his sons, Exodus 4, 23 and Psalms 2, 7, which it is argued is parallel to ancient Near Eastern beliefs that kings were thought to be divine offspring. And 3. Arguing that the evil marriages condemned in the verses were human polygamy on the part of these divinized rulers. We have already seen how the human view of the plural Elohim language in Psalm 82 fails, so that fundamental flaw need not be reiterated here. But there are other flaws in this approach. First, the text of Genesis 6 never says that the marriages were polygamous. The ideal must be read into the passage. Second, ancient parallels restrict divine sonship language to kings. Consequently, the idea of a group of sons of God lacks a coherent ancient Near Eastern parallel. The precise plural phrase refers to divine beings elsewhere in the Old Testament, not kings. Job 1:6, 2:1, 38:7, Psalm 29:1, and 82:6, 89:6, Hebrew 89:7. Third, the broad idea of human divine kingship elsewhere in the Old Testament is not a coherent argument against supernatural view of Genesis 6. It was God's original design for his human children to be servant rulers over the earth under his authority as his representatives in the presence of his glory. Restoring the loss of Edenic vision eventually involves creating a people known as Israel and giving them a king, David, who is the template for Messiah. In the final eschatological outcome, the Messiah is the ultimate Davidic king, and all glorified believers share that rule in a new global Eden. But it is flawed hermeneutics to read either ancient kingship or the glorification of believers back into Genesis 6. The reason is obvious. The marriages in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, corrupt the earth in the prelude to the flood story. A biblical theology of divinized human rulership in the restored Eden would not be corrupt and evil. In summary, the plurality of the phrase sons of God and the heavenly context of its use elsewhere show us that there is no exegetical reason to exclude occurrences of the phrase in Genesis 6:2-4 from the list of supernatural beings. What drives this choice is apprehension about the alternative. Peter and Jude. Peter and Jude did not fear the alternative. They embraced a supernatural view of Genesis 6:1-4. Two passages are especially relevant. But there were also false prophets among the people. And in greediness, they will exploit you with false words, whose condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but held them captive in Tartarus with chains of darkness, and handed them over to be kept for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a proclaimer of righteousness, and seven others, when he brought a flood on the world of the ungodly, and condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction, reducing them to ashes, having appointed them as an example for those who were going to be ungodly, and rescued righteous Lot, worn down by the way of life of lawless persons in lasciviousness. For the righteous man, as he lived among them day after day, was tormenting his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he was seeing and hearing. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from the trials and to reserve the unrighteous to be punished at the day of judgment, and especially those who go after the flesh in defiling lust, who despise authority. 2 Peter 2, 1-10. Now I want to remind you, although you know everything once and for all, that Jesus, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, the second time destroyed those who did not believe, and the angels who did not keep to their own domain, but deserted their proper dwelling place, he has kept in eternal bonds under the deep gloom for the judgment of the great day. As Sodom and Gomorrah and the towns around them indulged in sexual immorality and perused unnatural desire, in the same way as these are exhibited as an example by undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Jude 5:7-7. Scholars agree that the passages are about the same subject matter. They describe an episode from the time of Noah and the flood where angels sinned. That sin, which precipitated the flood, was sexual in nature. It is placed in the same category as sin which prompted the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. The transgression was interpreted by Peter and Jude as evidence of despising authority and the boundaries of proper dwelling for the parties concerned. All of those elements are transparent in Genesis 6:1-4. There is simply no other sin in the Old Testament that meets these specific details, and no other angelic sin at all in the Old Testament that might be the reference. The punishment for the transgression, however, is not mentioned in Genesis 6:1-4. Peter has the divine sons of God held captive in Tartarus in chains of darkness until a time of judgment. Jude echoes the thought and clarifies the judgment as the day of the Lord, the great day. Revelation 16:14. These elements come from Jewish literature written between our Old and New Testament, the Second Temple period, that retell the Genesis 6 episode. The most famous of these is First Enoch. That book informed the thinking of Peter and Jude. It was part of their intellectual worldview. The inspired New Testament writers were perfectly comfortable referencing content found in First Enoch and other Jewish books to articulate their theology. These observations are important. All Jewish traditions before the New Testament era took a supernatural view of Genesis 6:1-4. In other words, they were in line with 2 Peter and Jude. The interpretation of the passage, at least with respect to its supernatural orientation, was not an issue until the late 4th century A.D., when it fell out of favor with some influential church fathers, especially Augustine. But biblical theology does not derive from the church fathers, it derives from the biblical text, framed in its own context. Scholars agree that the Second Temple Jewish literature that influenced Peter and Jude shows intimate familiarity with the original Mesopotamian context of Genesis 6:1-4. For the person who considers the Old and New Testament to be equally inspired, interpreting Genesis 1-4 in context means analyzing it in light of its Mesopotamian background, as well as 2 Peter and Jude, whose content utilizes supernatural interpretations from Jewish theology of their own day. Filtering Genesis 6:1-4 through Christian tradition that arose centuries after the New Testament period cannot honestly be considered interpreting Genesis 6:1-4 in context. Our next step is to build on what we've learned. In the next chapter, we'll take a look at how the ancient context of Genesis 6:1-4 demanded a supernatural outlook for the passage. Doing so will enable us to understand its message and role in the larger biblical narrative.